Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Last Friday, I was stuck in my car without internet, and Jen was kind enough to amuse me and listen to the bad recording and the bad audio, and then I will spare you how long it took me to get it uploaded and everything, but I did, and Jen is back for another week, and I think that you guys are really going to enjoy this. Now, I say usually Friday's true crime time, and this is true crime, but it's so much more than that. I mean, there was a crime that took place, but it just is way, way beyond that. So, Jen, how are you?
I'm doing well because it's Friday.
It is. It is Friday. And, you know, there is an offshoot to this that I have wanted to talk about for a while, and we'll get to that. But this finder's cult and is just one of the most interesting things, and it happened so long ago. However, even though where everybody kind of first came into the picture in 1987, it is 2020, and under pressure from everybody out there, the federal government had to release a whole bunch of documents just in October 2019 because everybody still wants to know what the hell was going on.
This thing kicks off in 1987, and then you see years go by, and then you start getting these what I could call pings, you know, the 1990s, this case pops up again, the 2000s, it pops up again, you see a lot of documents become declassified, so it just makes it that much more interesting for us to dive into it.
So I think that the average person, prior to February 4th, 1987, had no idea who the finders were. None.
Probably not, but that was the time period of where there was the satanic panic and everyone was freaking out about child molesters and someone being behind every, I don't know, crevice and, you know, walkway wanting to steal their children. Like if you read about those times, it was just mass panic.
I know. I mean, there was this late 80s thing about, you know, that was when the satanic church and all these kind of stuff and everybody was just could see it. And they were just, oh, you know, it's the Manson, you know, abusive Satanists or, you know, and rituals and killings and sacrifices. And this was big for that because this is pre-internet. This is when you have urban legends, but, you know, there's usually a grain of something with the urban legends. And these people, while we're talking about when I just said there's no internet, you know, in 1987, there's not a lot of, you know, computer use. There's not a lot of, you know, there's no internet per se. You know, there's dial-up, there's message boards and things like that. But these guys were pretty far advanced for somebody in 1987, which kind of gives this, you know, that they were financed or had some money coming from, you know, the government maybe.
Yeah, possibly. When you get into some of their backgrounds, you see why they might have been so technologically enabled and why they had, you know, the computers and type of stuff that they did.
Yeah, because, you know, it's so rare. I mean, when there was something I read about MCI, you know, which obviously was a long distance company. And when people would use, you know, you had to use a card if you didn't want to use AT&T, and it's really kind of weird. But in February, in 1987, so this Tallahassee Police Department received a tip from an anonymous caller and alerted the police to a peculiar situation in a local playground. And these children claimed that they lived together and they gave this address in Washington, D.C. And that the children replied that the adults had to do what the quote-unquote game caller said. And this is just...
Yeah, this is a weird thing. So there's a lady, she's in a park, and allegedly she makes a 911 call. She says, hey, there's these two well-dressed men. There's six children along with them. They just piled out of a blue van. It doesn't look right. The kids they look malnourished. They have bug bites on them. Their clothing is dirty. You know, can you come check out the situation? Of course, PD responds. They start talking to these two men, and the men immediately, they don't have very good cover stories. They melt down. They go to talk to the guy. One of them's name was Houlihan, and the other one's name was Emmerman. So they ask these two guys, you know, hey, where are these kids' parents? And where's the mothers?
And they asked, where are you guys going? And they said, well, we're going to go to Mexico or something like that. And the kids, obviously, they didn't know what they were going to. And apparently back at this house in Washington, D.C., the children said they were not allowed to live inside the house. Which again is kind of odd. And one of the things that you discovered, which I found really, really interesting, If you want to go back, because a lot of people say that this is the precursor to Epstein, to Wexner, all of these kind of things. But one of the finder's group addresses links back to 629 Oak Street in Columbus, Ohio. And it's now known as the Discovery Special Improvement District, which was slated for cleanup in 2007. And just the fact that, you know, that right away we're back in Columbus and, you know, Wexner is around in 1987. It just kind of, when people say, hey, it feels like we are linking to that.
And it's odd because that address is almost always left out of the finders keeper stories. They'll bring up Washington, D.C., a warehouse, an apartment building, a townhome. They'll also bring up properties that are in Florida and also the Culpeper, Virginia situation. But that Ohio address that comes up synonymous with the finders company is always left out of these stories. And I'm like, why? Because when you look at Wexner and you start talking about Epstein and co-conspirators and everything that helped him aid and evade, you have to look at this finders cult and the fact that they are being accused of similar type things, because if they were running an international human and trafficking ring and moving children and women and stuff around, it's not that different than what we're seeing today in 2020. You know, Ghislaine's been arrested. Look at her charges.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so these two men, they were arrested for transporting six children. And like you said, they were dirty, they were unkept, they were underweight, and they weren't in the custody of their parents. These men, none of them were the parents of the six kids.
Yeah, or so it appeared at first. They started asking these men questions, and one of the men just shut down. He was like, you know, the mothers are not here. These children are on the way to Mexico to a school for brilliantly gifted children, and they're being weaned from their mothers. And then, you know, authorities are like, your story is no good. So they start to arrest the men. One of them faints. Like, that's his way of getting out of
this. Pretends to faint, I think you said. I think the police officer said he pretended to faint or something like that. Yeah, he went face down or something like that. And it's just kind of, all right.
How very dramatic. But they start going through their van, and this is where you bring up, you know, the computers. There's a computer in the back that is highly technological for the times. Lots of floppy disks. And then some other gadgets. And you can tell that all of this stuff is being used to communicate with someone, you know, who is not with them. He's somewhere else. And that's when they start interviewing these children.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is good stuff. Yeah. This is not junk. This is stuff that the average person at this time did not have. It was a luxury.
Yeah. And the children said, you know, they hadn't seen their mothers since before Christmas. I remember we're in February. And like you said, they said that they were being weaned off of mommy. And then the day after the Tallahassee police arrested the two men, a finder named Stuart Silverstone sent a priority report to Bob Myers. The finders were communicating. And then the criminal court issues a $100,000 bond for child abuse charges. Now, but do we know at this point? I mean, I'm glad that they did this. I'm glad that they put him on a $100,000 bond for child abuse charges. But it didn't look like at that point that the children had really been abused.
At that point, they weren't really sure, because they were putting the children through a series of question and answers. The kids, they were ages 2 to 7. So how much can you get out of 2 to 7 year olds? They were able to tell authorities that they were fed a raw diet, that the food was always a reward. You know, the only way they got it is if they minded the shot, the game caller. They were covered in those bug bites. They said they lived with several women and children. And these children were all unaware of what hot water was, what electricity was. Just common items to us were not common to them. They didn't know what, you know, TVs, phones, anything like that was. So the police found that to be very odd. And the children said they weren't allowed to sleep in the main house, that they slept outside.
And what's even more bizarre about that is it's obvious that the finders did have electricity. They did have phones because they had this, you know, communication system and computers. And so when Tallahassee investigators, so because everybody gave the address of Washington, D.C., so they call the Metropolitan Police Department and explain the situation. And the D.C. Police Department response was, holy crap, we've been looking at these fellas. And then the D.C. police called a phone number for the finders, and they got an answering machine with some kind of weird biblical toned message on it or something.
Yeah, these finders were definitely communicating with each other through the mailboxes, through those MCI, you know, phone cards that back then you really couldn't trace them, but they would leave voicemails for each other in those mailboxes, retrieve them, and then delete them. And then, of course, back then, you couldn't go and retrieve the deleted messages like you can now. But the more they talk to these children, the Mary, I guess she was the 7-year-old, she's called the eldest of the group, was the one that was most pertinent to the case because she gave them most information. She said, all of these men have different aliases. I think one of them is my dad. I'm not real sure. And they said, well, Mary, where are you going? Like, where did they take the kids? And she said, I don't know. We just keep going to campgrounds. They just keep shuffling us around, you know. And they asked her, you know, have you ever been to a school? And she said, no. They said, have you ever had any bad touches? And then she got really nervous and she asked for the interview to end.
Yeah, you know, just there's you can find the copy of it. That's one of the documents that was released in the document dump. And like she said, the campgrounds and then, you know, haven't seen the parents before Christmas and all this kind of stuff. And they didn't go to school. The two men teach them. And then, well, obviously the policeman's going to go, okay, what did these two guys teach you? And they said games and how to read. And then they did things for rewards. And the police officer, again, is probably thinking to himself, oh my gosh, I'm not going to like the next answer.
Exactly. So they send these children to HRS, which was the Human Services Division down in Tallahassee, Florida, to get checked out by a doctor to see if they'd been sexually abused. The original story is that at least two of the children showed signs of in-depth sexual abuse. And there are paperwork, just documents galore that the doctors wrote out and they explain exactly why they came to their conclusion. It's very damning to the finders. We'll go on to talk about where all of that went later on. You know, where did those documents go and why did this case didn't go anywhere? But I mean, when you look at that, you're like, what?
And also, if you think about it, okay, if there's nothing going on with any organization, then why did it take 32 years for these documents to come out?
Why were they classified?
You know, it just that's kind of the thing that was really weird. So you had mentioned Doug Ammerman, who was arrested. So they found David, his brother, and he told detectives that his brother had visited their parents in Gainesville a few weeks before the arrest with a boy he claimed was his. And Doug had told his parents he was heading for Miami. And David had said he'd lost touch with his brothers over the years, but wrote him a letter. And he showed detectives the letter. But the reply wasn't from his brother Doug. It was from the finder's founder, Silverman. And printed on the letterhead of Gung Ho Traders, which is a completely different address in Washington, D.C. This was the address of the finder's warehouse. Why did they need a warehouse? That's something I'm having trouble with.
Yeah, and here's the thing. When you go and you look at the U.S. Customs, because they get involved, the minute that these men brought up the fact they were going to take children across not just state lines but international borders to Mexico, U.S. Customs gets involved, FBI gets involved. Martinez at Customs agents are talking about what they find in the raids. They find a whole room dedicated to surveillance and videoing. You know, what does that sound like? Tons of computers, tons of floppy disk.
And one of the things is, so when they served these warrants, it was crazy. They were worried. So they found, you know, finders members weren't property, but no children, but they had toys and clothing from infants up to preschool age. And then documents on how to obtain children for undisclosed purposes, along with child-rearing books, how to impregnate members, kidnapping, selling, trapping, and trading children. There were several computers and printers in one specific room used by Stuart Silverman, a.k.a. the game caller. And there was a telex message from someone utilizing an MCI account to order two children from Hong Kong, arranged through a contact at the Chinese embassy. I mean, and then if you go back to one of the things that this Ammerman guy said, he said that he produced a second letter showing a letter addressed to his mother and signed by the three wives of Gung Ho. Now, Gung Ho is, you know, it's a common term, but it derives from Chinese, meaning work together in harmony, and said that, you know, Doug was going to China. So there's obviously they have this connection, and the finders are traveling the country and the world.
They are. And the thing is that when you have the Silverman guy and then you have the what they refer to as the original founder, Marion Pettit, his ties to not only being in the military, pretty high ranking, and being a chauffeur to top brass general. Also him, when he got into Georgetown and then he went into intelligence, he made a lot of Chinese connections. So it's not surprising to me for him to have telex you know, sheets lying around the Washington warehouse, because he goes on to talk about how he befriended a Chinese man in intelligence. That man went on to become a journalist. He operated out of the press club. And then when you look up a lot of these finders, you see that they spent a lot of time in residency at that press club, which is a hotel, and that their whole ruse was being journalists. And that's how they traveled all over the world. But they weren't exactly exchanging stories. It looks more like they were interested in trafficking, and especially maybe children.
Yeah, because, you know, like you said earlier, it was impossible to trace these kind of things. I can tell you from a relative that I have that they used, it was pretty easy for anybody any age to hack into one of these MCI things. They weren't really good about changing card numbers or making them different by very many digits or anything like that. But, you know, anywhere they are in the world, they can receive and send messages from anywhere. They use a touchtone phone, a computer, a modem, and then they have these password-protected mailboxes. They listen to it, and they delete it. And there's no way on this earth that investigators are ever going to know, you know, anything that was in that box. At that time, MCI or whatever long-distance carriers, they probably didn't save messages that were in the box. They didn't go to some server or something like that. They were just gone. I mean, this was a very secure way to do illegal things.
Yeah, and this guy knew it, this Marion Pettit, because he had trained in intelligence and he had been someone that was, you know, worked his way through the military. And also Mary, the eldest of the children, said that the computer found in the back of the blue van the children traveled in, that computer was used to communicate directly with the game caller. And the thing is with the game caller is if he did not want people to think that they were being manipulated into doing what he wanted them to do, what better psychological thing to run but to call it a game? And then it looks like, you know, you're participating in something and it's all for play. And it goes on to talk about how he would give these adults just very mindless tasks just to get them out of the way, to keep them moving. He'd say, so today I want you to just drop everything in your life, forget about all the money, and go out just barehanded with the clothes on your back and come back with $100, and don't come back until you make $100.
Yeah. Or go work a temporary accounting job, or go catch a flight to Japan on 2 hours notice to gather information on Japanese companies and then report back to this Marion Pettit. I mean, it was kind of really strange.
It is, because to live with this Marion Pettit and be a part of the finders, you had to live at this place called the New Ark. That's where they first would recruit you. And they would tell you that if you become part of this, you will get financial gratification, sexual gratification. You'll climb the ranks in a club of divinity. You'll be more tuned in than any person out there. But the thing was, is that when you came in, you would have to dump all of your money, you know, your life savings, into what he referred to as his invisible bank. And that was a commune. And anyone in the Finders Club, allegedly, could use that money anytime they wanted it. And it, you know, for, when you look at the Finders, and some of them do go on to give interviews, it seems like Marion Pettit is the one who used the majority of the money.
So when Tallahassee, they call up to Washington, D.C., and the... In her report, she wrote, he asked if I thought that there was a possibility there may be more children in either of the locations, the Glover Park home the women and children resided in, or the Northeast warehouse that the men called home. And the investigator stated it may be true, but didn't have any specific child that I knew of there. He stated that he was going to get search warrants on both locations and try to serve them later that date. But they were looking for evidence of kidnapping, a federal crime, or any lewd offenses described in the affidavit. And then there was, in also 1987, Detective James Bradley, and he received information from a confidential source. And the source said a group of subjects calling themselves the Finders, a cult, were conducting brainwashing techniques at two locations in D.C. And like you said, inductees to the cult were promised financial rewards and sexual gratification. And the source said that the children were used in rituals by the members of the cult. Now, the source never personally observed the being abused, but had conversations with grandparents of the children who feared for the children's safety. And the source also stated that during the latter part of December 1986, he personally had conversations with one of the original members, a guy named Alan Schoen, who wanted to explore Satanian with members of the cult. So this judge, Gene Dwyer, approved the warrants to investigate the Finder's locations.
And the whole time that's going on, you have the Finders trying to make themselves look not guilty. And they're saying, you know, we're just a hippie lifestyle. We're practicing alternative lifestyle parenting, you know, look away. And authorities are like, you know, no, we're not going to look away. And then you find out that behind the scenes, the finders have this thing called the game. So one of the things the game caller would send the adults out to do was to shop the classified ads. And they would pick on parents that were looking for babysitters or tutors. And these finders would come into your home. They would watch your children. And they would surveillance you, basically, surveillance the family. And they would write down their habits, their schedules, you know, things about the kids. It's kind of creepy.
And one of the things is when I talk about 1986 and then how the D.C. police have been looking at them, they talked about a clearing approximately 70 yards behind the house. And think about this for a second, a clearing approximately 70 yards behind the house. Glover Park is extremely expensive. It's over by where the Washington Zoo is. To have a 70-yard, 210 feet behind the house, okay, this is a massive, massive place. And so they said there's a clearing approximately 70 yards behind the house and several stumps surrounding the open area. And several round stones have been gathered near the circle. And this practice is sometimes used in satanic rituals and evidence that several persons had gathered in the clearing recently. And the rear of the residence is covered from the alley by heavy bamboo growth, save a small entrance to the rear yard. In the rear yard was a small, very ornate gravestone propped up against the support pillar for the porch. And this is came out of some of the documents that came out in late last year. You know, these were things that weren't, you know, necessarily known. But all of this stuff, like you said, this is 1987. It's the perfect storm. You know, you had Michelle Remembers came out. You had the McMartin preschool case, right? You had bands that everybody said were Satan worshipers and things like that. So people were into this. And I think that that has kind of kept a hold from them from 1987 until now. When the doctors investigated and did the examinations of the children, they couldn't rule out sexual abuse in two of them, but they couldn't confirm it either. And then you have the moms, and I'm putting that in quotes, come forward and with these perfectly reasonable explanations. Oh, we were traveling to California, and there was supposed to be a job there, and, you know, it didn't really work out. And no, it wasn't a sacrifice. We were just showing the kids how goats are killed.
They literally raided the warehouse and in the Virginia property, and there were actually photos of the children sacrificing goats. I mean, these kids were doing it by themselves, and the adults were clothed in white robes and standing around watching. Of course, the adults went on to say that they wore the white robes as to not dirty up their clothing. It was just sheerly to protect them from the blood.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
And so one thing, so I had mentioned that about this telex, where ordering two children. Okay, as soon as I see a telex message to order two children from Hong Kong, arranged through a contact at the Chinese embassy, you guys are going to jail forever. Okay?
You would think, right? But no, the more that the U.S. Customs, and it's Customs that does the majority of the talking. It seems like the FBI, they talked a little bit, and then you see them backing away and backing away. And you see the CIA come in, but the U.S. Customs agent, Martinez, he does not give up the fight. He's like, no, I know what I saw. There's photos of children, photos of their genitals. It was all staged. It looked crazy. And he's like, I'm not letting it go. I'm going to send all of this stuff to Congress. And he does.
Yeah, because there was another telex which discussed bank secrecy in these situations. And another discussed acts of terror and ways to carry them out. There was a printout of where the two members had been arrested in Tallahassee alongside a telex that gave details on how to keep the children moving through multiple jurisdictions to evade law enforcement. And at least one resident at the finder's location was a Chinese national.
Yeah, which Mary went on to say that the Chinese man at the warehouse taught her to count at least to 10 in Chinese. So, you know, she puts him there, too. And when you look at what's going on with the Hong Kong embassy, that's very troubling. And the neighbors at the Virginia farm compound said that they did see children being brought in vans, and the children were always crying.
Let me ask you this. So you have, we started this on February 4th, right?
Yes.
And then we're at February 5th. And this is when we get a U.S. Customs Service report. Why? This is their reasoning. They said, it's just kind of weird that all of a sudden they popped up, and there's some kind of stuff that's redacted, but it says the duty agent received a call from blank, USCS, so Customs Service, was seeking assistance in contacting an appropriate local police agency to coordinate a child abuse investigation in with the Tallahassee Police Department. The Tallahassee Police hadn't said anything where anybody was going to be, I guess to Mexico, that was the original story. And then, of course, that was backed off and they said, no, you know, I don't know why I said Mexico. That's just, you know, crazy. I didn't mean to. But like you said, this guy said U.S. Customs was contacted because the police officers involved suspected the adults of being involved in child pornography and knew the Customs Service to have a network of child pornography investigators and of the existence of the Child Pornography and Protection Unit.
Because you have the telex linked to Hong Kong. They also found things that were linked to, here's the crazy part, a lot of countries that the U.S. was engaged in combat with or having conflict with, countries like North Korea, Moscow, it goes on and on. The Bahamas, not that they were fighting with the Bahamas, but that was in there. The United Kingdom, Japan, these finders were linked to lots of different places. So that's exactly what brought in, you know, customs, FBI. Anytime you cross state lines, you're going to bring in all these people. But you see that even the State Department gets involved, and all of a sudden everyone's turning against the Tallahassee Police. You know, like you said, Tallahassee gets real quiet because DC Metro is saying, we're not seeing a lot to investigate here. And the FBI is like, we're withdrawing. And then you have poor Tallahassee just kind of hung out to dry.
And good for them. You know, right away, they were there. They went to find it. They arrested these guys, $100,000 bond in 1987, which is huge. And they're just doing the best that they can because he got these kids, six kids, and, you know, who, and nobody's got a good story of why these well-dressed white males had the custody of the six children. And they, I guess, they were also behaving like wild animals in a public park. And so they were living out of this 1979 Dodge van, with a Virginia license plate. And, you know, the white males refused to cooperate, one of whom produced a business card with a name on one side and a statement on the other. And the statement indicated that the bearer knew his constitutional rights remained silent and he intended to do so. So, I mean, they're prepared for this kind of thing. You know, I mean, who walks around with a card unless you know that at some point you might get busted? You know, I just thought that was really odd, too.
Oh, the whole thing is odd. But I mean, it just all goes back to Marion Pettit and the fact that he was the one who started all of this and talked these people into basically doing his bidding for him. He's a retired Air Force master sergeant. You know, he's linked to intelligence. He's linked to some of the most, you know, I'm talking the high up brass generals. Like, he knew everyone. And at least one of these military men that are very high up go on to help him acquire that Virginia farm property. They help him make one of his first payments. So when you look at what he's linked to and then what he goes on to get by with, you can't help but question, where is intelligence in all of this? And then you have the CIA swoop in and say, we're going to take the investigation over from here. It's now an internal matter. All other agencies are to back away, stop looking into this, and it is now classified.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, hey, we're here, we're going to take over, and you're never going to know anything about this for however many years, you know, 32 years. And it's, to me, when I say, okay, CIA, and they're ordering, you know, kids, then, you know, they sell the kids to some government, and then the CIA has leverage over them or something like that.
Well, it's weird because the CIA denied it for the longest time. For years, they denied that they had anything to do with the finders or what was going on. But as the Associated Press leaned in and the Washington Times and things like that, they start to break down a little bit, which I've really never seen the CIA cave like that. But they said, listen, we did some business with Marion Pettit. Okay, we did some business with this thing called Future Enterprises. They do train CIA employees in some type of computer data, but, you know, we didn't know anything about the finders. However, we did get into something that went bad, like really bad.
And so did Marion's wife work for the CIA for like 8 years or something like that too?
Yes. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, he's got family wrapped up in it. This Pettit guy, his wife worked with the CIA legitimately. She was employed there. And then also you have his son. And what did his son do?
You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's just, it's all crazy.
His son was a pilot for Air America, which is linked to hauling opium around. And, you know, that becomes a scandal all within itself. But when you have that many family members linked to one intelligence house, you know, it makes it that much more suspicious.
It does. I mean, and you know, the CIA, well, yeah, they were training us. I mean, come on. If they're training you and somebody's working for you and somebody's a contractor pilot for Air America, and then this customs person, the one that wouldn't give it up, like you said, you know, they found these photographs and the nudes, and they believed to be members of the finders. And there were numerous photos of children, some nude, at least one of which was a photo of a child on display and appearing to accent the child's genitals. And the customs guy says, I was only able to examine a very small amount of the photos at this time. However, one of the officers presented me with a photo album for my review. And the album contained a series of photos of adults and children dressed in, like you said, these white sheets, participating in a blood ritual, the execution of two goats. And it's not just the execution, it's the disembowelment and the skinning. And then removing the testes of a male goat, the discovery of female goat's womb, and the baby goats inside the womb, and the presentation of a goat's head to one of the children. I mean, and then there was files related to activities of the organization, like you said, London, Germany, Bahamas, Japan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Africa, Costa Rica, and Europe. Then there's also a file identified as Palestinian. Other files were identified by member name or project name. The projects appearing to be operated for commercial purposes under front names for the finders. There was one file entitled Pentagon Break-In, and others referring to members operating in foreign countries, not observed by me, but related by a Washington, D.C. police officer, were intelligence files on private families not related to the finders. I mean, come on.
Exactly. So, yeah, come on. And then you have to start looking at, okay, so who are these finders, or at least who are some of these finders? And you have to look at Robert Toby Terrell. And that is a man that gave multiple interviews to, I wouldn't say mainstream media outlets, but some of your indie ones. And he said that he had worked at the IRS for years. He had a wife and kids. He completely abandoned them to join Marion Pettit on his whole divinity, fuller, deeper meaning of life, you know, search. So this guy goes and he lives with him, and he says, I shared a toothbrush with this guy for 20 years. And the guy, by the way, looks like Charles Manson. I'm not judging. I'm just telling you that that's
bald hair. Goatee, but not a full beard kind of, but shaved head kind of thing. And, you know, and he sat down for an interview back in, 2018, I think. So please, you know, go take a look at it. The guy, you're right. Charles Manson.
Yeah. And he's a word salad. He goes on to say, we're not in intelligence, but we are in intelligence, and Marion Pettit wasn't, but he was. And in fact, like, yes, we were in with the CIA, but no, wait. We are the DIA. We're the Divinity Intelligence Agency, and we do yoga, and we tune into things that other officers can't tune into. So basically, he goes on to try to explain that what the finders find is human potential. And he's just trying to say that we're out trying to find ways to make humans potentially useful in finding ways of earning money, whether it's sending them out to be journalists or collecting intelligence, even if it goes against the CIA or basically our own government. We're just out being not spooks, but kooks.
One of the crazy things was when he's a spokesperson, and he said at a news conference that, and we're going to go back in time. I'm just one thing that he said, which was interesting. And he said that the finders was disbanding, and he gave no reason. And he said, quote, this is farewell from the finders. We're breaking up. You won't hear from the finders again until the Chinese are running Hong Kong. And what are the Chinese doing now? They're running Hong Kong.
Isn't that something? How everything old is new again.
I just thought that, you know, and he could have been talking about 1999 when the handover was, or he could have been talking about something like now. I'm trying to see. Yeah. Okay. So this is something that you had mentioned too. Also, it said during the course of the search warrants, this is the customs guy. Numerous documents were discovered which appear to be concerned with international trafficking in children, high-tech transfer to the United Kingdom, and international transfer of currency. And there's page 2 of 2, details of investigation, March 31st, 1987. So these are not just kind of like, you know, ginned up documents. These are the actual investigative, you know, as they're happening, contemporaneous of a customs investigator. And he sees all of this stuff.
Yeah, these are real documents. You have documents, 27 documents from the State Department. You have at least 40-something documents from U.S. Customs. You have the FBI. They have their own stuff. Tallahassee has their own reports that were just released in 2014 after they finally caved to the Freedom of Information Act. This was a real live case.
Yes, and this is not, okay, this is not some interview in 2018 where some random guy who worked in customs who might have been on the case for 5 minutes is interviewed, and that's used as justification for something. This is a guy that we have the documents as he was writing them during the course of investigation. And that's the best kind of thing to have.
He said, I had access to every single building, every square inch of it. I know what I saw, and I know what happened afterwards. Because they go on to try to not only move this guy out of his position, he gets accused of doing something inappropriate at his customs job, unrelated to the finders, but he calls it a setup. So basically they're trying to get him fired. And he said, this case has done nothing but cause me personal problems. So he eventually backs out and he doesn't speak to anybody after, gosh, it looks like, what, 1993? He just kind of quits talking.
Yeah. And he said on March 31st, 1987, I contacted detective and it's blank. I'd really like to know that detective of the Washington, D.C.
Have that. That is going to be Sergeant John H. Stitcher. And he was with the D.C. Metro. And that guy did not meet a good end.
Really?
Really, he died. And the thing is that there's a conspiracy theory. I need his autopsy report, but they said there was arsenic found in his blood. Now, of course, his cause of death was listed as something a little bit different, but he did kind of die suddenly, mysteriously. And they did tell him he received a memo, and that is in at least one of the files, to stop pressing into this investigation. We suggest that you step away. It's now classified. It's out of your realm. Basically how Acosta told people, you know, hey, this is above your paid grade. Back out. Stitcher just continues to meet with Martinez. They met often to discuss the case. It made a lot of people angry. And the next thing you know, 1993, Stitcher's dead.
And that's when the customer Martinez stopped talking about it too, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So Jen bringing the tea. And he said that I was supposed to meet with him, about the documents seized pursuant to the two search warrants. And the meeting was to take place on April 2nd or 3rd, 1987. He gets there at 9 o'clock in the morning. The detective wasn't available. And I spoke to a third party who was willing to discuss the case with me on a strictly off the record basis. I mean, it's a criminal investigation. It's off the record. And I was advised that all the passport data had been turned over to the State Department for their investigation. The State Department in turn advised that the D.C. Police Department that all travel and use of the passports by the holders of the passports was within the law and no action would be taken. But this included travel to Moscow, North Korea, and North Vietnam from the late 1950s to mid-1970s. So they were traveling to countries that were adversarial to the United States.
Absolutely. So who gave them that clearance and what were they doing there? I mean, that screams links to intelligence, whether or not they were just assets, operatives. There are three different kinds of people that can help, you know, intelligent houses. And then there's also what they called NOCs, which I tend to think Marion Pettit was probably a NOC, which is someone that he kind of operates in underlying ways, you know, to help an intelligence house. But if you get in trouble, they don't exactly give you any type of life preserver. You know,
you
drown.
Have no official cover.
Yeah, you have no cover. You know, they say, hey, we don't know you. You're doing our bidding for us, but hey, we don't know you now. So I tend to think that's what he was.
And if you think about it, that's kind of what the Air America people were too. I mean, they were contractors in quotes of the CIA. And if you think about North Vietnam from the late 1950s to mid 1970s, if you think about North Korea, if you think about Moscow, I mean, and then you have the customs guy saying the individual further advised me of circumstances which indicated the investigation into the activity of the finders had become a CIA internal matter. So again, same thing that we got with Epstein, you know, CIA, like you said, with Acosta, and it's kind of like the CIA just feels like they're running some kind of, child selling operation, you know, and
it's hard to tell if they were selling children exactly in this instance or if they were dangling them in front of people in order to bring in other, you know, human trafficking type people. You can never tell in these different little operations they have going on because the CIA likes to know what's going on out there. You know,
so
same
you think
thing
maybe they were ordering the kids, right? We have that telex where they're ordering the children. But we're not sure that the children were ever delivered. However, we now have the CIA has, you know, something on the hook for this person. Hey, you ordered children or something like that.
Exactly. And welcome to blackmail. And I tend to think that might be what this operation was about. Not only a social experiment, but a dangling operation to see what's out there and who they could get their meat hooks in. Because these people, they do a little bit of dirty work, but they didn't exactly get caught. You know, sexually molesting anyone. The State Department lets it go. The DOJ lets it go. Why? You know, maybe because it was a covert operation to get maybe some of the more heavy hitters.
But do we think that maybe the finders themselves abused some of the children?
Someone had to have abused at least two of those children, because in the FBI documents, which they're in the vault and that's available online, I'll link it. I'll make sure NT links it on his Twitter. You can read. There is an in-depth report. It's very disgusting about what exactly they found in the examinations of the two children. So something happened to those two. But when it comes to intelligent houses and what morality, sadly enough, is always going to be the lower worry. So do they have a couple of casualties when they're doing operations like this? Yes. But, I mean, who were they after? When you look at this, what was all this about? You had the finder companies. They operated out of not just the Finders Keepers, but Finders Transnational, Finders Transnational, Ragged Mountain, General Science Corporation, Women's Network Science, and Future Enterprises. What were the intelligent houses doing with all of those companies? What were they really after?
Exactly. And then if you think, there was an interview that was done with Marion, but it was in a book called The Finder's Keeper, an interview with Marion Pettit. And a 1994 reference work, this is from their book, it was by Ken Thomas and Lynn Bracken. A 1994 reference work on utopian communities refers to the Finders as a rather spontaneous non-organization. Their overall approach to life is to make it into a game, a challenging and educational process where the rules change from week to week, day to day, sometimes even by the hour. But contrast that with investigator Ted Gunderson's handwritten description attached to Treasury Department memoranda on the Finders that Ted Gunderson circulates in an info packet about the group. And he said, quote, "The Finders are a CIA front established in the 1960s. It has top clearance and protection in its assigned task of kidnapping and torture programming young children throughout the U.S. Members are specially trained government kidnappers known to be sexual degenerates who involve children in satanic sex orgies and bloody rituals, as well as murders of other children and slaughter of animals." Now, that's what he says. But, you know, could it have been that, you know, obviously we think that a couple of the members were abused, but do you think that it could have also been that's what the Finders wanted people to think, or something like that?
Yeah, because the CIA goes on to say years later that, yes, we own this. They came right out and said, yes, we own what was going on with the Finders, but not in the sense that you think. It was actually a covert operation, and it had to be ran clandestine, because when you talk about taking kids off the grid and having them live in the country, and then you bring them to the city and they look like they're just wild animals and people are calling 911 on you, yeah, it looks bad. So we operate covertly to keep all of that at bay, because basically we wanted to train our officers in computer programming and just computer technology. This Pettit guy was hooked to that Future Enterprise, and we needed that. And then what he went on to do after that, or what he did, he kind of did like an Epstein, in my opinion, is that he started operating outside the scope of what they asked him to do. And that's when intelligence gets real ornery with you, and they'll either, you either disappear or they just cut ties with you. So with this guy, it looks like that they severed ties with him. But I think they were just using him for his tech talks.
Yeah. It just, you know, and the CIA's explanations have been lacking. I mean, like you said, you know, they said, oh, yeah, the CIA made one contact. You know, but then they admitted to owning the Finders organization as a front for
they
domestic
did.
Computer training.
Straight up.
But like you said, that it had gone bad.
Yeah, and they didn't go on to describe how it went bad. Like, you know what? They started molesting children that bad. They started gutting goats that bad. I mean, you guys, what's bad? Define it. Define bad. Because the thing is, like those Florida politicians, you know, you said they ended up being really quiet in Tallahassee, but they pipe up in the 90s and they say, hey, So if there wasn't something to all of this, you know, why are the Washington men scrambling? Why was the CIA scrambling? Why was all this stuff classified? And that's when they start kind of opening it back up. Even though it all gets closed in a nice bow, they still tried to reexamine it.
Yeah, that was in 1993, and you had a North Carolina representative and also a Florida representative who really wanted to publicize this investigation. And there was even a former CIA operative named Skip Clemens who also wanted it all to come out. And because until it starts happening, you get these things like the goat sacrifice, like I said. They've been attributed to the finders just play acting at being witches and warlocks, you know, another game to dumbfound lookers on. But the thing is that nobody was looking on until 1987.
Yeah, you know? Until they made themselves, you know, just really out there into the public. But to hear Marion Pettit talk about it, to hear the Terrell guy talk about it, all the finders were out to find was just ways of influencing decision making. You know, controlling people, keeping their mind busy because idle minds are dangerous. If someone hired them up and they would charge what is called a finder's fee. So was the CIA paying a finder's fee? I don't know. But they said that they got paid finder's fee to busy people, especially counter movements, beatniks, things like that. And it would make other operations run smoothly.
And next week, Jen and I are going to talk more about Marion. We're going to go over an interview that he gave for this book. And talk about some other things and how this kind of 1987, and then it leads into a little bit, you know, you had the Franklin credit scandal that happened in 1988, just kind of a short time after this, and how the two kind of shared the same secretive universe for a little while. So yeah. I'm excited about that. I'm excited. You know, the whole John Sitcher thing, thank you for that. I mean, that's pretty cool. And now I got to go find out about him and the arsenic and all of that stuff. So, anyway, Jen, I appreciate you, and this is an amazing case, and I can't wait to talk about it with you next week.
Yeah, super exciting. So thank you for having me on, and I hope everyone has a good weekend, and especially you.
Oh, thank you, and have a great weekend yourself.
All right, bye.
Bye.